The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
On Wednesdays, starting about 2 weeks from now, on October 28th, and then for the two Wednesdays after that, so November 4th and November 11th, and that'll be over at the IMC Annex, which is the little classroom over on Brewster. It's just a couple blocks from here. And the topic is called Sutta Study as a Support for Practice. So the suttas are the written discourses of the Buddha. So if you're interested in learning a little bit about the source material of our tradition, this will be a nice, gentle introduction. You'll get an overview of the whole structure in case you were lost by looking at all those big books. And then we'll read some suttas together and talk about them with other people. So I think it should be a really nice introduction if you're wanting to look at the written teachings. Okay, thanks. So tonight, we've made it to the third week of our three-week series on body, speech, and mind. So that means today we'll be talking about the mind. And these are three realms of training that the Buddha talked about, or prescribed even. And certainly in my own experience, I've found it valuable to pay attention to each of them as separate realms and kind of explore in each of the body and our speech and the mind where there can be freedom and how what can be learned from observing those realms. I know they're not totally separate, but it is a useful distinction to separate these three. So the mind. During the first week, actually, on the body, there was an excellent question at the end about the kind of the relation between the body and the mind and which was more important and isn't the mind more important? That was said during the body week. And I think they're all important. We'll learn that by the end of tonight. But there is a sutta and where the Buddha is asked about which of the three realms, body, speech, and mind, is the most important. Or specifically, the question is actually, which of these is the most reprehensible in terms of karmic result? So if you misbehave in body, speech, or mind, which is the worst? That's the debate. Okay, so he's actually debating with a follower of a different school. So he's debating with a Jain, sometimes pronounced Jain, which is another religious school, basically. And the Jain follower proclaims that it's the body is the most reprehensible. Basically, he says, what does the trivial mental rod count for in comparison with the gross bodily rod? He uses the word rod as each of these pathways. And the Buddha contends that it's actually the mind. The mind is the weightiest of the three. And in this particular sutta, the Buddha wins the debate by offering examples. For instance, he points out that the mind can overpower the body to the point where the body could die. And the example that he gives is that there could be a monastic who, of course, he's using the example of a Jain monastic, who is told that his precepts, his vows, say that he can only have hot water to go with his medicine. But he may have a disease where cold water is prescribed by the doctor. And so then there's an internal debate, and he could decide that his vows are the most important, and he could allow his body to die by not taking the cold water medicine. So essentially he says, therefore the mind has more import, more weight than the body because of this ability to direct the body in that way. And he also catches the Jains in an inconsistency. They do declare in their ethics that volitional actions are more reprehensible than unintended ones. So if you meant to harm somebody, it's different in karmic weight than if you didn't intend to and just accidentally did something. And even the Jains would agree that the intentional case has more karmic weight. And the Buddha says, well, intention is a mental factor. So he sort of catches them in an inconsistency. You know, the bodily act is less important than the intention behind it. So in the end, of course, the way it works out in the Buddhist version of this story is that Jane loses the argument. So there's no doubt that the mind is central to Buddhist teaching. I mean, that's what we're doing. We're training the mind. We're liberating the mind. I hope people in here understand that the body is generally going in one direction, and we know which direction that is. But the mind can be developed and can develop all the way until death and can always get more wise, more compassionate. That is not inhibited at all by the state of the body. Yeah? But I would say that rather than taking this sutta to mean that only the mind matters, or to somehow place the mind above, we can recognize simply that the mind is behind both bodily and verbal actions. And so our efforts in the realms of body and speech do in fact point back to the source of the mind. So we've made it to the source, if you will. And there's also, of course, the famous lines from the beginning of the Dhammapada. This is Gill's translation. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a pure mind, and happiness follows like a never-departing shadow. So for sure, we're working on our mind. So the question is, how to work with the mind? And, you know, as we've noticed in the earlier practices, there are kind of two broad ways to do the work of this practice. One is to train through doing intentional practices, to deliberately train, like you go to the gym and train. And then another realm is to sit back and observe and just watch what actually does happen and then learn from that. And even those are not completely separate, but those are two general approaches. We can actively do something to train, or we can observe what's going on and learn from that. And these apply in the mind also. So we'll start with the general mode of training the mind. Actually, mind training itself is a wonderful phrase, and it's a common phrase across many Buddhist traditions. The mind is well worth training. There's a little pair of sayings from another text that says, where the Buddha says, I do not see even one other thing that when undeveloped leads to such great harm as the mind. An undeveloped mind leads to great harm. I do not see even one other thing that when developed leads to such great good as the mind. A developed mind leads to great good. So mind training is essential. It's very important. And the mind, as you've probably learned, is not going to change without some effort. If we just go along, we'll just keep going along. So this is a little passage from Matthew Ricard on an essay he wrote called Why Meditate? So it's a little bit about motivating ourselves to train the mind, because it is effort. And he says, we have no choice about what we already are, but we can wish to change ourselves. Such an aspiration gives the mind a sense of direction. But just wishing is not enough. We have to find a way of putting that wish into action. We don't find anything strange about spending years learning to walk, read and write, or acquire professional skills. We spend hours doing physical exercises to get our bodies into shape. To sustain such tasks requires a minimum of interest or enthusiasm. This interest comes from believing that these efforts are going to benefit us in the long run. Working with the mind follows the same logic. How could it be subject to change without the least effort from just wishing alone? That makes no more sense than expecting to learn to play a Mozart sonata by just occasionally doodling around on the piano. We expend a lot of effort to improve the external conditions of our lives, but in the end, it's always the mind that creates our experience of the world and translates this experience into either well-being or suffering. If we transform our way of perceiving things, we transform the quality of our lives. It is this kind of transformation that is brought about by by the form of mind training known as meditation. He says it very well. So I'm really not going to try to summarize all of meditation in this talk. That would be a tall order. But I will describe the landscape of mind training, if you will, including common mind states that are created through practice and common ways of observing the mind in order to move toward liberating insight, which is what we're aiming to do. So we'll start with the active mode of training, the sense where you're actually deliberately doing something with your mind in order to strengthen it, like lifting weights with your muscles to strengthen the muscles. And maybe the first realm that's commonly explored is motivation or intention. So as Matthew Ricard noted, he's a monk, by the way, a Tibetan monk, we do certain things because we have some underlying sense that they're beneficial. Yeah? So what is your motivation to practice? It's not an idle question. It's actually something that's worth investigating at various times in our practice. I don't think we need to obsess about this and really work on it and write it down and stick it on the fridge. I don't know about that. I think that can actually limit the mind a little bit, but being aware of our motivation and the fact that it changes over time is really valuable. I've had a number of different motivations to practice over the amount that I've practiced so far, and I think it was valuable to allow that to shift over time as things changed. You know, lo and behold, you might actually meet your goal of what you were meditating for, and then there needs to be another one, in a sense, it needs to deepen. So we are offered teachings that help guide the mind in the regard of finding motivation. And a common one in our tradition is called the five remembrances, if you will. And these are remembering that, first of all, the first three are remembering that we're subject to aging, illness, and death as human beings. So this is kind of the urgency motivation, is that even if we're young, we've certainly, up to this point in our life, experienced illness of some kind. And it's not pleasant to be ill. And you can probably take just a little bit of imagination and imagine that you could get an illness that is not just the common cold that you'll be over in a few days. You know, but it is a serious illness that could threaten your life and would be very unpleasant and maybe difficult to practice through. And so then we realize, oh, while I'm healthy, while I'm able to get to IMC, and while I can still drive, while I can still concentrate a little bit, now is the time to train the mind. There's not going to be a better time than now, because these other things are surely going to come. So those are the first three, aging, illness, and death. And then there's the reality of change in one's life, even if we're not talking about these inevitable kind of permanent changes. There are all kinds of changes that happen that disrupt our life in various ways. Our relationships end, for example. Either they just end because of separation or a person dies who's close to us. This, again, is a challenge to us. Everything that we like, the things that we've tried to gather for ourselves, have the potential to go away. You know, our car can get broken, our house can burn down, etc. So the things that we have around us are not that reliable. And so we need to train the mind to be able to accept those changes, to be resilient to those things that are just part of the normal flow of human life. And then if those all sound like they're a little bit downers, the fifth one contains a little bit of a ray of hope, which is, although it's also talking about the way we're bound, it's the principle of karma, of actions having results, actions having consequences. And so, of course, we understand that if we just allow the mind to drift along and be caught up in its greed, its agitation, its anger, its stupor in front of the TV, those kinds of things, well, that's just going to continue. You know, that trend doesn't change without a little bit of effort. And then the positive side of it is that we can develop the mind positively also by that same principle. All the moments of kindness, of patience, of awareness, mindfulness, of love, of concentration, all of those moments strengthen those qualities, and they make the mind more prone to that. It actually becomes easier and easier to be mindful the more mindfulness we do. That's pretty good. So these five teachings help us remember that how valuable training the mind is. And I guess it'll depend on your mind type, whether you're, you know, interested in the side that is avoiding the difficulties, you know, avoiding suffering from the inevitabilities of human life, or the aspiration towards training the mind to something wonderful. Maybe it's worth mentioning that other traditions include different things in this list. One that I like is that some traditions include the preciousness of human birth. And you don't have to necessarily believe in reincarnation or believe all of that, take on all of that philosophy, to appreciate that a human life is actually a very special thing, a wonderful thing, that we have this body, this rich experience, the potential for meeting other people, for changing, for developing ourselves, for experiencing all the power and potential and 10,000 joys and sorrows of this life. What an amazing thing. How did we get this? I don't know, but here we are, right? It's pretty interesting. And so that, for me, that's a motivator to say, wow, you know, what can really be done with this human mind that we've been given? What can really be done with that? I don't want to die not knowing how far that can go. And we can also examine positive aspirations. They're not part of this five remembrances, but why not our deep wish for ease, for joy, for happiness that's not dependent on conditions, for peace? These things often resonate for people also. These are motivations that inspire us. So these are deliberate ways to train the mind. You know, you can actually sit down and remember these at the beginning of your sitting. Just connect in. It doesn't have to be a lot, but, you know, 10 seconds, 20 seconds. It's really good to reflect on that. Some people also find it inspiring to do what's called taking refuge every day, or from time to time. It doesn't have to be every day. And this means to consciously accept that the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha are providing an orientation in one's life. The teacher, the teachings, and the group of people who practice, these are the things that are important to me. Yes, maybe I also have, of course, a family, a job, other children, other concerns in my life, but they're oriented around, you know, the way I act in those realms is oriented around these inspiring things to me, these things that I know are reliable refuges for my life. So to remember what's really reliable in a changing world. Another area of, big area of deliberate cultivation that we can do is to develop our heart, you know, to develop the heart qualities that are called the, in Pali they're called the Brahma Viharas, which is kind of a fancy word, but it really just means heavenly abode, actually, divine abode. And these are mind states that are expressions of the heart, so there are four of them. One is loving kindness or metta, another is compassion or karuna, and the third is empathetic joy or mudita, and the fourth is equanimity or upekkha. And there's a reason why these are called Brahma Viharas. They're safe places for the mind to abide, essentially. We know that our mind does not always abide in loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And sometimes our mind is abiding in anxiety or in fear or in avarice or envy or anger, something like that. And, you know, we can't always control the weather that's coming through the mind like that. But when we do have periods where we really feel filled with compassion, or we really feel filled with kindness or friendliness, the mind can recognize, aha, this is a good place to be. This is sort of, if this were sustained, it would be really good. There's that general feeling. And so we're encouraged actually to appreciate that and tap into that, that when the mind is in these strong heart quality states like that, to appreciate that and to wish that they will persevere and to direct the mind toward feeling those things, especially in challenging situations where our habit might be to go in another direction. Basically, strengthening these qualities leads to higher quality experience in the mind. And so this kind of development takes the mind out of its limited self-oriented concerns. And actually, that in itself is a huge relief. The mind would really like to be out of its little pigeonholed self-oriented concerns about how am I going to get this done? What about this? Am I getting, you know, taken advantage of in this situation? All that little stuff that we can concern ourselves with, we really would like not to have all that. And we think that the way to do that is to make our life perfect and get all those other people to do what we want them to and get all of our possessions set up the way we want them to and get our health in shape and all of that. But in reality, that's really hard to do because things change and we can't really control other people very well. And so there are alternatives, like changing the internal state of the mind, which actually then ironically does change the external in certain ways. But it has to start inside. Now, granted, if you do these practices, well, let me describe the practices a little bit. The usual way to cultivate these qualities, it helps to read about them, listen to talks about them. In addition, there are specific practices that are offered in the texts, often associated with imagining particular people and then generating these heart qualities toward them. So, for example, in the case of metta, we are encouraged to develop metta for ourselves, for a benefactor, for a good friend, for a neutral person, which means someone that we don't know, so a stranger essentially, and then for a person that we find difficult or challenging in our lives. These get increasingly harder to deeply feel that sense of friendliness and goodwill. But that's what we do. And then eventually we spread that to all beings and just widen the circle out to everything. Or it's possible also to just feel the quality internally and radiate it in all directions. That's a second way to do this practice. So I should add that these are purification practices, these heart quality developments. And they're not guaranteed to be 100% pleasant, even though it is very pleasant when the mind is filled with goodwill or compassion or equanimity or joy. Intending to bring those about tends to clean the heart of the things that are its opposite. So if you're practicing goodwill, you may discover ill will, discover the ways in which your heart is not free in that. And it has to be that way, because if you want to remove those boundaries, you're going to have to run into them. And so you find them there. And it's worth it to persevere, not push against those boundaries. These practices are meant to be done gently, but to have the faith and confidence that continuing to intend in that way is going to strengthen these heart qualities. It's best to combine Brahma-Vihara practice with mindfulness, therefore, so that we're aware of when the mind is reacting or producing the opposite of these intended mind states. And then we meet that with mindfulness. We say, ah, look at that, there's ill will. Not, oh, I'm so bad, I have ill will. Oh, I'm so terrible, I'm a failure at loving kindness. It'll never work. I knew I shouldn't have done this. Forget it. That's not very mindful. So there's a way of attempting to practice loving kindness. Maybe you feel it for a while, and then you start thinking, well, there was that time my friend did that thing, and I'm kind of annoyed with him about that still, and that starts coming up. You start replaying that situation. Then you have the mindfulness, and you realize, oop, I've slipped into the time of remembering when I wasn't so happy about this person. And then you just notice that. And noticing that without getting caught in it is the beginning of breaking down that wall and being able to feel the loving kindness, even for the friend who did that annoying thing. So development of the heart is one very common way to train the mind. And it's a great way to start, and it's a great way to finish. It's a great way to practice all the time. In addition, There are other practices that I want to highlight, and another large area is that of concentration. So the mind can be deliberately trained to become more stable. Actually, the Brahmaviharas, these heart qualities, are themselves also concentration practices. If you can really bring the mind to a stable feeling of loving-kindness or a stable feeling of compassion or equanimity, that is a something for the mind to gather around, basically, to hold on to and gather around. But in addition, the Buddha offered many other types of concentration practice. In fact, a total of 40, believe it or not, 40 objects. Most likely you're familiar with the breath. You know, that was what I mentioned during the guided meditation. So the breath is a wonderful concentration object. It's actually always there, usually, we hope. And for many people, it's easy to tap into. And for many people, they find it soothing because it's a gentle, changing object. This is good for the mind to have something like that rocking back and forth a little bit with the breath. So it's a great, great object for concentration. In fact, the Buddha was said to do breath meditation in his own practice. So it comes well recommended. I have to be careful. I've casually said the word concentration practice, and people tend to have an association with that of focusing down like a narrow laser beam. But I would say that concentration practice is really aimed at bringing the mind to stillness. And it's not very still to have this strong, you know, laser focus. That's sort of not the right kind of effort. You can actually force the mind to concentrate a little bit in that way. I'm not saying it's totally ineffective, but it's not very stable, actually. You'll find that getting into concentration through force doesn't last very well. Actually, concentration is achieved by letting go of things that are not the object. It sounds very simple, but if you want the mind to gather around a single object, like the breath, every time the mind is not there, it's letting go. Oh, my mind is thinking, letting go. Oh, my mind is caught up in anger, letting go. Of course, it may not be that simple. The mind may come back again and again to what it really wants to think about. But essentially, concentration is about letting go. It's a practice of relaxing and letting go, and simplifying and unifying around this one experience. One way that I like to think about it is that the body, the emotions, the thoughts, and any other mind objects are all related to that one theme of the breath, if you're using the breath. So you're feeling the breath in the body. You may experience thoughts, but they may be thinking about the breath, for example. If you're experiencing the pleasantness of the breath, you may focus only, you know, mainly on how does the breath feel, not how does yesterday's conversation feel, those kinds of things. So, and the intention is to stay with the breath. So everything in the mind is kind of related to the breath. You don't have to be single-pointed, that's all that's there, but just everything in the mind is kind of related to it. And then you have this experience of gathering and settling, kind of like the way that marble slowly spins and spins and spins and eventually is going to get to the bottom of the bowl. That's it, actually. That's the art of concentration. But the question is why? Why do that? Stillness is important to be able to see clearly. The aim is not actually just to experience a still, concentrated mind, but to be able to see. How could we see anything from the deck of a tilting ship? It's better to be on dry land. Or how could we see if we're holding the telescope in our hand, stick it on a tripod? It's better, right? So the ability to gather the mind in some way is an essential step on the path, and it's part of this directed training that can be done. Fortunately, it's very pleasant when the mind can do that. I know it doesn't always happen, but when the mind can, it's very pleasant. So it's best to work with a teacher if you're seriously developing concentration, because there are some pitfalls that are good to avoid since it's so pleasant. It can be misdirecting. So another way that the mind can be deliberately approached with practices And the last one I'll talk about before moving to observation is through investigation by questions. I like this practice a lot. This is now moving into the realm of insight. And there are fantastic questions that we can pose to the mind. I mean, I say fantastic just because I'm excited about them. There's nothing special about them. But there are ways that when the mind does get a little bit settled, we can start to investigate what's there, start to look at the mind, learn about this amazing thing that we're walking around with. So I'll give some example questions that teachers have recommended. One teacher from Korea says that he often uses the question, "What is this?" Very simple question. But, you know, it's like you've got this mind and you're sitting there and you say, and something appears in the mind. It's anger or it's a body sensation or it's an intention. And you just say, "What is this? What is this?" And, you know, there are many ways to answer that question. It's not, the answer itself is not super important, but you could name what's happening. So we could do the noting practice. Oh, anger, thinking, sadness, tingling, that sort of thing, going through the mind in a series. Or we could say, "What is this? Like, I'm feeling the breath. What is the breath? Wow, I don't really know. I mean, the breath is just a concept, but the experience of the breath is a whole cascade of sensations through the body. Very interesting. How do you know you're breathing? I mean, how would you know? Turns out it's a series of particular physical sensations that you recognize as a pattern. And so you can investigate, what is this? It leads to a sort of a sense of wonder for me, wonder of what this mind and body really are. Another, this isn't a question exactly, but Ajahn Sumedho often uses the phrase, "It's like this." And this is, again, this is often good for a mind that's a little bit scattered or is not quite clear or is not happy with experience. You know, why, you know, I'm angry, going over and over again this argument I had yesterday. And then you could just keep getting caught in it, or you could use the phrase, "Oh, anger is like this." Anger is like this. Very liberating to be able to just say, whatever's happening, this is what it's like. I'm learning what this is like. So try that sometime. Utejaniya points the mind toward the quality of awareness that's present. So he uses the pair of questions, "Am I aware?" and "What am I aware of?" among other questions, but these are two basic ones that he uses. So, "Am I aware?" and "What am I aware of?" And this is helpful because often the mind is a little bit fuzzy or drifting a little bit, and that prompt, "Am I aware?" I mean, as soon as you've asked that, there's the mindfulness. You can experience the awareness of that moment. And "What am I aware of?" then reminds the mind, oh yes, there's an object present, and it helps me connect with experience, essentially. Another useful question I've heard from many teachers, especially if the mind is fairly settled and is okay with the way experience is, this is for a state when you're feeling pretty content and calm, you can ask, "Who knows this? Who knows this? What is that knowing that is experiencing this?" And it, what it does is it turns the awareness from the objects or the sort of sensation out there that I'm experiencing, it turns it around and looks at what is knowing. So it doesn't allow the mind, therefore, to identify with the knowing that's going on. For me, the experience is one of, like if I say, "Who knows this?" or "Who experiences this?" There's a little release and a sense of, I mean, there's no answer to that question. There is no answer. And so when that is asked, the mind stops a little bit, has to stop for a second, and then it's nice to kind of rest in that space. So I recommend that as a deliberate practice. So this transitions us then into the realm of observing the mind, not necessarily doing an active practice of asking a question or bringing about a concentrated state, but actually just observing what is there in the mind. In order what? to learn about it, to learn how what the mind is and how it works. So there are realms that are recommended to look at in a number of teachings, particularly the flagship teaching of our tradition, the Satipatthana Sutta. And I won't go through all of them, but I'll mention that one thing that we can observe is just presence or absence of certain qualities. So presence or absence of desire, presence or absence of aversion, presence or absence of delusion. It's interesting to see that the Buddha recommends that we observe the presence of delusion in the mind. Could we see that? Very interesting. Check out for yourself if you're able to see the mind in a deluded state. And then various other states like contraction or expansion of the mind, and whether the mind is concentrated or not. And I like these observational techniques. Notice the different flavor, just presence or absence of. It's not that we're trying to generate the concentration. It's not that we're trying to turn away from the desire, aversion, or delusion. Just note if it's present or absent. And if the mind isn't caught up in hatred, it's okay for there to be hatred in the mind, actually. It might be useful to observe it. Hatred is like this. So I like the freedom of these observational techniques where the mind is as it is, and our job is to observe it like a scientist observing animals in nature or observing something in the lab. It's not really our judgment about what it is. Our task is to know it. In addition, we're asked to observe certain states in the mind, so hindrances like restlessness or sloth and torpor, sluggishness or doubt, or positive qualities of the mind, factors of awakening like energy or joy or tranquility or equanimity. And in each of these cases, it's useful just to know that those things are present or absent. And in addition, there's instruction around noticing, starting to notice causal links between things. So we're asked to observe, how does desire arise? And what conditions in the mind make it likely that if I don't have desire this moment, I'm going to have it next moment? You know, how does it come about? And similarly, if there is, say, aversion in the mind, what conditions make it likely that that aversion will fall away? What does it feel like when it falls away? These kinds of observational techniques that can't happen, actually, if we're controlling the mind and saying, I want a mind to be full of loving kindness, which is a great thing, but you also have to at some point observe what helps bring loving kindness about, what helps preserve it once it's here. If it should fall away, what happened that allowed it to fall away? This is really useful to know about the mind. So we're especially asked to observe these causal things of arising and passing and what causes what. And this is the beginning of wisdom. This is what wisdom amounts to, is knowing how the mind works. And you find that out by observing it. Actually, that's a perfect quote in that one of Joseph Goldstein's teachers, Munindraji, said to him, if you want to know how your mind works, sit down and observe it. So simple. Hard to believe it actually works, but it does. So, observation of the mind can tend to lead toward a very broad awareness. We start to develop a mindfulness that's stable, in which other things can arise and pass. Anything can arise and pass, maybe. At first, it can feel like the mind is very sticky and it jumps around and we're only able to be aware of certain things and then it's swept away. But eventually, that stability of the mind grows and it becomes broader, emptier, more like the ocean or like the sky. And the qualities, the things in the mind, are smaller than that and they can arise and pass. You know, lust arises and passes. Anxiety arises and passes in the vast space of the mind. And this allows the mind to start having insights. Yeah, anytime we're in this observational mode, we might have an insight. But this, we get more prone to them, shall I say, as we develop this kind of observational stance on the mind. And we may observe how things change. Everything changes. We may observe how that means that nothing is reliable, really. Nothing that can arise in the mind is going to last forever. And so we can't count on anything being there forever. And there's a certain unsatisfactoriness then about these transitory things that are coming and going. And that means that those aren't really the basis for our self-identity, if you will. These things that are coming and going can't really be the lasting self that we imagine we have. My experience also with this kind of observation is that we begin to get a flavor very generally of what mental activity itself feels like. It's very interesting. So everything that arises and passes in the mind is some kind of mental activity. It's actually, and that everything that arises and passes in the mind therefore shares some quality of being a mental state, a mental activity. And you can sort of blur the mind out and not worry about the fact that this one is love and this one is hate and this one is anxiety and this one is intention. They're all just stuff in the mind. And we can actually aim toward relaxing any kind of activity in the mind. Once it starts to have that single flavor of just something happening in the mind, a little energy burst, we can say, what would it be like if that energy were just to calm down, calm down, calm down? And so we begin to see that even the observation is itself actually a mental activity. So I've talked about doing active practices and then observing as something that's more relaxed, which it is. But we begin to get to a point where even observing, like that looking, we see the mental activity called looking as another mental object. And then this leads to letting go of, you know, being able to let go even of the observation at times, because it's too much effort. What if we really truly want to be as relaxed as possible? I would encourage you to see how far that can really go. Now, maybe the first time you'll just fall asleep. Oh, I got really relaxed. I totally fell asleep during that meditation. But having the aim of the deepest possible relaxation and peace in the mind can go very far. So development of the mind is necessary, for sure. But whatever the mind can be developed into isn't actually the final goal. You know, the aim is to let go. And in the end, the mind itself is let go also as one more thing in experience. I found along my path that we tend to go through cycles of intentional development and observation in the training of the mind. Like sometimes it can occur in a single sit. We might spend some time at the beginning getting concentrated or gladdening the mind through Brahmavihara practice, and then at some point settle back, say, into open awareness in the course of a single session. But even more so, over months and years of practice, there are these phases where you may feel drawn to developmental practices for a while. You know, metta, concentration, compassion, challenging your internal assumptions, you know, taking on the judge that's yakking in your mind all the time. These are active practices, and they're really valuable. And then at some point, that may seem too active. And when you sit down, you don't want to do all that. You actually just want to sit and just let the mind flow, just tune into what's going on. Both of those are totally normal and wonderful ways to practice. It may be that that observational mode leads to some insight about the mind. And the result of that insight may very well be that you realize you need to do more development and you need to start up and, you know, do something else. Oh, wow, I really need compassion now. I never bothered with that, but now's the time. You know, and I would encourage you to trust what you're drawn to in practice. You know, maybe listen, maybe now that you've listened to this whole talk, you might look back and think, what resonated for you? You know, which parts were you falling asleep during? And, you know, which parts did you say, oh, that sounds interesting to me, that catches my attention as a way that I think I would be valuable for me right now. So, I mean, the path of developing things in the mind and the path of letting go and observing, I think, are just two sides of the same coin. So probably fully freeing the heart's going to take a lot of both of them. So, yeah, think about what you're drawn to and go with that and just trust that it's going to bear some fruit, and then you'll change and you'll have to do something else. So body, speech, and mind work together. They're realms of practice that we cultivate and that we observe and that we learn about the mind and that we can let go over time and become freer and freer in all those realms. So may your practice be multidimensional. I hope you won't take this talk to mean that only mind practice is important. Sometimes the best thing you can do is go out and do some exercise, something like that. Yeah, but in the end, we're freeing the mind. So it points back to the mind. So I'll stop there. It went pretty long, but so if you need to leave, it is 9:00, but I would love to open it up and hear any questions or comments, and particularly maybe the areas that you feel drawn to right now. This is a chance to kind of state publicly. Yeah, please, wait for the microphone. Yeah. What's up in your mind? That's what I want to know.
Okay. I was wondering, actually, I was going to first ask why does meditation work? And as you were talking, I kind of thought about that. And you started your speech by saying mind is the source of everything. And I thought that if you anchored your mind just like we do during meditation to your breath, then you're able to let go of your thoughts. And I think the effect of that, then you don't cling to other things in your life either, because you do not cling to your thoughts. And then I was investigating the last couple of weeks the feeling that I had when I was practicing meditation, which is, you know, we talk about precepts and we talk about karma, we talk about, you know, doing the right thing and following certain principles, etc. And I had this moment while I was meditating that none of that mattered. And I became very suspicious of that and kind of even terrified, because then it seemed to me that you only have your breath as an anchor, and this whole other structure that we talk about as the concept of Buddhism and what to do and what not to do and how to be and how not to be, for me, it kind of fell away, and then I didn't know what to do. So I don't know if all of this makes sense to you. I just wanted to share.
A follow-up question, which is, what did you mean by saying they don't matter?
Maybe that's not the right way to position it. I stopped thinking about it, basically.
Okay.
I stopped...
your mind actually became
investigating.
A little bit...
I stopped investigating it. I just had this feeling, you know what? It there's no need to analyze it so much, you know? And, well, then, you know, that creates another problem, because there are 50 shades of gray in life, you know, as you encounter a lot of situations. So, for instance, you know, like, you know, you're supposed to be truthful, right? But you're running a company, and you're running out of cash, let's say, and a lot of people are working for you, and if you tell them that you're running out of cash, people are going to leave. You can't say that. So you need to lie. Now you're lying.
Well, wait a minute.
You know?
Do
you know what I'm saying? So, I mean,
scenario,
maybe
yeah.
The intention behind it is to make the business work, and maybe so that's not bad, but technically you're lying. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, it sounds to me like there's a lack of clarity about, I mean, what you've discovered is that desires compete, right?
Yeah.
And so then there needs to be some clarity in the mind about
right.
You know, what the actual value there is. But I think this specific scenario is maybe just an example of something where you're basically asking, if I'm sitting in meditation and not tracking very carefully these things about right and wrong and
right.
karma, have I lost my bearings? That's what I hear in what you're saying. And if I just focus on the breath and that's what is most important in my experience, do I sense a little bit of concern that those other things are going to fall away? Even when you get off the cushion, you're not going to pay attention to those other things? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, it was actually a pleasant feeling. It was kind of relieving. I'm like, oh, okay, you know, like
yeah,
I don't have to worry about it so much. You know?
There you go. So the analysis of right and wrong and karma and so forth is thinking activity in the mind. And it's worth investigating, you know, if not thinking about that at certain moments is feeling healthy for the mind,
uh-huh.
it's probably worth trusting.
I agree.
It may be that the doing the right thing is not necessarily the result of thinking about doing the right thing.
Interesting. Okay. Okay.
Worth investigating.
I agree. But not too much.
Well, investigation can be other things than thought. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for your practice also. Anyone else?